Greetings, friends. This is John Haspel, and I am the Dhamma teacher at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. The podcast will begin in a moment. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for additional podcasts, Dhamma articles, and a calendar of our weekly classes and monthly and yearly retreats. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you find this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you, and enjoy the talk. The idea of this retreat is that the focus is the truth of happiness. The Buddha taught awareness of suffering so that we can develop lasting peace and happiness. And that's basically the focus of the Buddha's teaching. And at the core of that teaching is to empty ourselves of all clinging. That's the reference to emptiness that relates to the Four Noble Truths. And I put down on the bottom, I'm not trying to get anybody excited, but there's an important distinction between what the Buddha meant as dependent origination and what it has grown to be, meaning interdependence. And there's no relationship between the teachings on dependent origination and interdependence. And I'll get into that. But it's an important point because dependent origination is a key teaching of the Buddha. And if we're confused about it, we're going to be confused about the entirety of the Dhamma. So we have to know what the Buddha's intention was when he taught these things. I'll get into that in a little bit. This afternoon we talked about the three linked characteristics of life in the phenomenal world and how a self arises within that and how we also awaken within that environment of anicca. And so the Buddha gave two teachings on how the self arises and what it is that functions within this, within the environment of anicca, and what it is that is subject to dukkha, to stress and unhappiness and confusion, to continual stress and confusion and unhappiness. And that's what he identified that as non-self or not-self, anatta. And then in the teachings he described, well, how did this take place? And again, remember that Buddha is not teaching annihilation. He's teaching that what we believe we are is not it. It's not self. You have the wrong idea. And that goes back right to the first factor of the Eightfold Path, is right view. In a deluded or ignorant view, and it's interesting the Buddha describes what ignorance is, and I think it's important for us all to hear it. The wrong view is just that this is it. This is what we are, and we have to continually defend it. And so how did that arise? And that's where the teachings on dependent origination came from and refer to. Nowhere does the Buddha talk about interdependence or interconnectedness. In fact, if you look at that from a wrong view, interdependence and interconnectedness is a matter of joining this ego self with everything else, forming more connections that we just have to unravel as we do the work of unbinding. You know, so it's definitely not a teaching that the Buddha gave. We use it in certain ways to acknowledge our dependence on each other. But again, we need to be clear that there's no attachments between this ego self, or there's no attachments that should be held to between this ego self and all other phenomena. It runs contrary to awakening. It runs contrary to unbinding. I'm going to go back one paragraph to where I was going to start because it kind of sums up where we are. The Buddha's second discourse, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, or the Sutta on Non-Self, teaches that the elements that make up a self are all impermanent. He further teaches that these elements all have a cause and that the cause can be abandoned. Enlightenment, in the context of the Second Noble Truth, means that the origination of stress and unhappiness, clinging to objects and all views of an ego personality, have been abandoned. That's the Buddha describing awakening as far as the Second Noble Truth. You've abandoned all clinging. We've emptied ourselves of clinging. If we'd emptied ourselves of clinging, we're not interdependent or interconnected to anything in the phenomenal world through our ego, through non-self. As one develops an understanding of the Dhamma, it is important to always be mindful of the context and intent of the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha consistently impressed to be mindful of what he taught and why. I teach the origination of dukkha and the cessation of dukkha, nothing more. The Buddha avoided any issue that would prove to be a distraction to his stated purpose. In fact, the Buddha could have just as accurately stated, I teach the origination of distraction and the cessation of distraction. It's the constant preoccupation with dukkha that keeps us distracted from who we truly are. It's what takes us out of the present moment. It's what throws our minds to the past and to the future. It's what causes anxiety and compulsion and addiction and all the rest of that, arising from initial distraction, which itself is born of ignorance. It is a preoccupation with stress and unhappiness that distracts one from awakening. It is a distraction of dukkha that prevents liberation and freedom. As stated in the previous chapter, let me skip that. Life in the phenomenal world is often experienced as arbitrary and personal, while at the same time predetermined and unavoidable. We're thrown to the winds every time something happens. It's unexpected. And yet, somehow, we create this idea that, well, it's part of my karma. It was predestined to happen. And that all arises out of a negative view of self, that there's something wrong with me and I deserve the suffering that I have. Right? Everybody has experienced that. We blame ourselves for the... We blame our nature for what's going on with us rather than our own choices. And it's a way of, it's a subtle way of not taking responsibility for what's going on in our lives. The Dhamma is a way of taking responsibility for everything that occurs to us in an impersonal way. Dependent co-arising explains the process of the formation of a personality, a self, and the process of maintaining the self. And I'm referring to the non-self that the Buddha talks about. Not self. Dependent co-arising explains the impermanent environment that the distraction of dukkha arises and the steps necessary through heightened wisdom, heightened virtue, and heightened concentration to reverse the formation of the ego personality. So I'm going to read in a few minutes how the Buddha takes the teachings on the 12 causative links, dependent origination, dependent co-arising, that starts with ignorance and ends with birth and suffering. And in reverse order, we undo it, we unbind it. And it's a direct process that the Buddha teaches. And it's a simple understanding within the context of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. It's a useless teaching outside of that context. In other words, if we try to fit it into some other concept that we have, it makes no sense. But it makes perfect sense in this context. And a lot of the Buddha's teachings are, all of the Buddha's teachings are like that. The teachings on the five skandhas that I'll talk about tonight make no sense at all unless you understand that the Buddha is talking about an ego personality that has arisen through these 12 causative links. Karma and rebirth is so grossly misunderstood when it's taken out of this context that we are causing our karma in this present moment. The general understanding of karma is that it's all bad and it's all because we did something wrong. Karma is completely dispassionate and impersonal. It's just the unfolding of our past acts impacted by our present moment mindfulness. And we'll get into that tomorrow night. Dependent co-arising is also known as dependent origination. It is the Buddha's teaching on how personal phenomenon arises within the environment of anicca, impermanence. The entirety of the Dhamma is to bring understanding of the Four Noble Truths. It is within the context of the Four Noble Truths that understanding of dependent co-arising develops. Understanding dependent co-arising brings awareness of the relationship between the five clinging aggregates and the phenomenal world. The five clinging aggregates are physical and mental factors that cling together to form a personality identified as self. Dependent co-arising explains the 12 causative links that determine the experience of the ego personality. So before this can arise, there first has to be ignorance of the true nature of reality. And the reason why the Dhamma works in creating lasting peace and happiness is it's a practice of wisdom, virtue, and concentration. You know, I talked about that this afternoon, that wisdom shines a light on ignorance. Ignorance is gone. We understand how this occurs. And again, this teaching on dependent co-arising is to let us know what happened and how we got to where we are. In the Patika Samuppada of Abhanga Sutta, the Buddha presents the 12 causative links of dependent co-arising. Each of these 12 links are required to cause a self to experience confusion, disappointment, sickness, old age, death, and rebirth. So the first, I'll just go through the 12, beginning with ignorance. From ignorance as a requisite condition come fabrications. arising from not understanding the true nature of who we are, we create mental fabrications. We create concepts and constructs that we are then stuck in, unless something gets us out of it. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. And we're talking about consciousness in relation to the five sense bases. You know, we're not talking about some kind of mystical overarching consciousness. It's this consciousness that arises from ignorance, and so it is stuck in that ignorance. There's nothing inherently intelligent about this consciousness that the Buddha is talking about. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. We talked about that this afternoon. From name and form as a requisite condition comes the six sense bases. So out of that identity of a personality attached to a physical body, then the six sense bases come into play. The six senses plus consciousness. We've now developed something that is prone to suffering, that comes through these senses. Does that make sense? It becomes a little bit more clear. Keep in mind that this is in relation to the Four Noble Truths. The five clinging aggregates explain what it is that's experiencing this, and then understand the process of awakening is unbinding all of these views. From the sixth sense basis as a requisite condition comes contact. In other words, we have to have physical senses before we can come in contact with anything. And it's that contact that gets discriminated as we go along that starts creating the confusion and delusion of dukkha. From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. We first have to have something that says, I like this or I don't like this. For the next, and that's discriminating consciousness that's impacted by the physical senses. So did I go a little too fast there? Name and form creates or leads to the six senses. Out of the six senses, we're through contact, something impacts this thing that has arisen from the five clinging aggregates. Am I going too far and too fast? This is key understanding, and I don't expect you to completely understand dependent origination from a 10-minute talk, but are you following me? Yeah, okay.
John, will you read that last sentence again, starting from the beginning?
I will, and then I think I'm going to go back to ignorance. I'm not saying anything, there's no judgment there. I'll do that because you asked. From contact?
Before that.
From the sixth sense bases, as a requisite condition, comes contact.
So from touching, tasting, smelling, seeing, hearing, comes contact. Something that those senses can interact with.
Something has to be formed in order for contact to take place. The Buddha is saying it arises from ignorance. What he's talking about, we have to lose the concept of a physical birth takes a 9-month gestation in a woman's womb. That's not what he's not trying to describe that physical phenomenon. What he's saying is what happens in ignorant discerning thought that gives rise to these other things. Right? From not understanding.
The evolution of personality, he's talking about what happens at every moment?
At every moment and in an instant.
Okay.
So this is a process, as I'm reading it takes time, but it all occurs in an instant.
Okay.
It all occurs from a wrong understanding of the nature of reality in this present moment. It reoccurs. It's continual because of conditioned thinking.
Because it sounds like this is something that this is how a personality is formed, but that's not what he's saying. Well, in a sense, he says that this is how a personality is formed second by second.
Let me go back to something that I skipped over. Maura, you had a question?
I was going to say, and do they necessarily, you can see the sequential nature, but I also, do they kind of happen simultaneously in some way? Like, it's not that they're so clearly delineated.
There's other teachings where the Buddha's teaching dependent co-arising, and he changes the order somewhat. So, again, he's explaining components of something that happened in an instant. In order to communicate it, I can't just say, blah, 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 and you understand all these concepts. They're not necessarily linear, mm-hmm. but they're founded on ignorance, and they end up in suffering. So, and that's really the key teaching, and maybe it's better to say it that way. From ignorance comes suffering. And it's within this process that happens through this psychophysical body that we experience it. And so, because it's happening, and it appears to be happening to this, we say, well, this is what's having the experience. And that's where the misidentification of who we are comes from. Through contact, we think this is it, this is us, this is happening to me, I need to defend this because it's all I got. And that all I got is the ignorance part. And we get caught up in it. We get caught up in it because we have that consciousness that's tied to this. And maybe that's a better explanation, I hope. Because it's such a difficult concept.
In the end, you have somebody who wails, why is all this stuff happening
to me? To me. Yeah, to me. Well, it's not. It's not happening to you. Except that was what you attached to. That's why we need to empty ourselves of clinging. Lisa.
So I'm not sure I got it, but I'm going to walk my train of thought through.
Please.
I guess the first thing I'm hearing, I heard the fabrication, which to me is just the lie, whatever the thing is that I've told myself or that I've decided is this thing. So then the next is I take it either on me as a person or I take it on as my character, and that's what I get attached to.
Yeah, you take it on as you. You know, and we all do that.
It's not so much a physical thing, it's more conceptual.
Ultimately, it's attachment to views. You know, our views are played out in the objects of the physical world, but they're all views of self. They're all things that we decided that we are, or things that we have associated and joined with. And that's an infinite number, it's not one thing. But then you can say that. And the reason why this is significant, it is one thing, it's ignorance. We're joined to ignorance, and we defend that. That's what we really defend. And if we can gain something that will develop wisdom, which begins with right view, this is, again, I know I'm going back to the Eightfold Path continually, but I kind of decided that was what was most important this weekend. Right view is the beginning of wisdom. Wisdom eliminates, however you want to describe it, leaves behind, blows up, unbinds us from ignorance. And it's from ignorance that all of this suffering comes from. So the Buddha taught this path, the virtue, concentration, and wisdom, in order to turn ignorance around and empty ourselves of clinging. And that's where freedom comes from. You know, you could look at it in a, what's the right word? Maybe not metaphorical, in a visual way. That there's strong bonds, strong rope bonds or chains, tying this body to all the things that it attaches itself to and that it identifies to. The Dhamma is cutting through that. We read that story that the Buddha said. It's like a farmer's plow cutting through the roots. This is what we're doing, is cutting all of our attachments, all of our views of self. The difficult thing is that they're all views of self. We don't want to let go of that. It's all that we know. But when you understand that, again, the significance of the teaching within the framework of the Eightfold Path is that it's arising from ignorance. If somebody came up to you and said, I'm going to tell you a story about dependent origination, and even if they were a brilliant teacher, more brilliant than me, you'd say, well, that's interesting. Well, what good is it? But within this framework of the Eightfold Path, it's one of the jewels of the teaching. And that's, again, why I emphasize that it doesn't mean interdependent. I'm not putting down the concept of interdependence and interconnectedness, but this is a key teaching. You know, this is one of those teachings that deliver liberation and freedom. A little bit earlier on, I metaphorically connect this to the five clinging aggregates are the vehicle, and the factory that creates the vehicle is dependent origination. And that factory is running 24/7. This process that the Buddha is talking about is going on continually in our conditioned mind in order to keep creating what we're experiencing. that thought can sound almost overwhelming, but all that it is a change in view that interrupts that process. It has a lot of energy behind it because we've been living that way for so long, but all that's required is a change in view. That's why the Dhamma begins with right view. Charlie.
Yes, I was thinking about how to make this maybe a little simpler and clearer. We can go back to our blueberry example. And you developed a taste for blueberries, but you've overdone it and overindulged, and you have an aversion for blueberries. And not only do you have an aversion for blueberries, but you see yourself as being a bad person because you don't see anybody else but this aversion. You have this whole blueberry story going on in your mind. And what the Dharma wants to do is to cut through that and detach you from the blueberries.
Yeah, and point out that it's just an attachment that you have. You know, the blueberries are neither here nor there. They're not good, they're not bad. They're nothing to attach to because next season it might be plums. You know, let it go. That's a perfect example of what this is about. It sounds a little complicated. For one thing, these 12 causative links, we're trying to fit it in to our views of self. That makes it more complicated. But in maybe that simple way is the best. Out of ignorance comes suffering. You know, and it's through this process of this physical body that through its senses, you know, we all know that we have senses. You know, we use them all the time. Through those senses, impacted by discerning consciousness, suffering occurs. If you interrupt the beginning point, the causative point, ignorance, the rest of it doesn't happen and no suffering arises. Another way of saying it is, what's an awakened person? An awakened person is someone who is empty of ignorance. They don't see things in any other way except as it is.
Detached from blueberries.
Detached from blueberries.
Can I make a clarification on something that I said that I heard referred to earlier?
Of course.
So when I made this, when I said today, you know, the Buddha said, know when you're walking, know when you're sitting, know when you're lying down. It's my understanding that when he says no, he's talking about no, the word no, sampajana, which is clear comprehension. So it's not mindfulness, like we talk, the mindfulness, the common, you know I'm standing, I know I'm sitting. It's the big knowing. Are my mind states wholesome or unwholesome? Are they leading to suffering or are they leading to true happiness, the truth of happiness? Are they leading to unbinding and clinging or are they leading to a creation of self? Is my action, why am I doing what I'm doing? How does it fit into the path? And what's the wise discernment going on in this moment while I'm walking, sitting, lying down, defecating, going to talk to you? Is it going to be helpful or unhelpful? And are the conditions right to say what I need to say or do what I need to do now?
That's a perfect example of another teaching of the Buddha, that the mundane aspects, the things that don't do much for the ego, are overlooked. Getting to the later teachings and forgetting the foundation. That the Buddha talking about when you're walking, be mindful of walking, comes after he teaches the foundation, and that we want to forget about being. What he's really saying is to be mindful of the breath in the body, be mindful of feelings, be mindful of thoughts, be mindful of mind while you're walking.
Right. The whole,
but if you forget about the
dependent origination, yeah, right? You know,
the same thing in this, getting to that point, I guess I've made it a few times, but it's important. Because the word dependent is in this teaching of the Buddha, we forget about the teaching and attach our own views of what dependent means. And then we make it pleasant, and dependent is not good. You know, we don't want to be dependent on anything or anybody. So then we interject something that's a little bit more palatable. Well, we're interdependent, and that sounds nice. You know, we can accept that. We've completely forgotten what the Buddha's intention was here.
So the whole thing that dependent origination means is this leads to that.
This leads to that, and that's another good way of putting it. You know, the teachings of the Dhamma can be characterized as a teaching on causes and conditions, and this is a specific one. From the condition of ignorance, the cause of suffering follows. We first must have that. We can't have suffering without ignorance. I mean, that's an incredibly freeing thought. I just need to know what the truth is then. And how do I develop that? It's clearly laid out here. You know, ehepasiko, come and see for yourself. But don't create other fabrications based on these teachings. Don't make them something that fit into something you'd like to experience. The Buddha's teachings on interconnectedness between human beings are so basic that we don't want to see it, we just don't see it. The Buddha teaches that we connect through understanding our own suffering, and then we can understand other people's suffering. That's the point that the Dhamma takes us to. That's true compassion. And that's where we can really do something with another person, when we understand their suffering, because we've taken the time to understand our own.
So that's where we're interconnected.
That's the point that we're in. And it's not in some semi-mystical way. And if we really understand how we got to where we are, and the point of suffering born of our own ignorance, if we know that, then I know where yours come from, and I can tell you. I mean, I can actually be of some value to you, saying, this is what I did. This is the way I used to live my life. This is exactly what the Buddha did. The Buddha said, I was a completely deluded, ignorant human being. I strove to understand, and now I do. And I'm going to tell you if you want to listen.
So
you
know? Compassion is not, I feel your pain. It's I know where
it comes from. Yeah. And there's also an aspect of, in the teachings, I got to find out exactly where it is. But it talks about compassion alone is not enough. In fact, it says compassion by itself can be a dangerous and hurtful thing. Mm-hmm. We must marry it with wisdom. We must know when and why and how to act. And a good example of that is just trying to commiserate with someone, which often just leads to more suffering.
That's empathy. That's not compassion.
Yeah, but we often think that it
but
is.
But it's not.
Well, and you know the endless conversation of you poor dear is usually not helpful. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't let people know that we care about them, mm-hmm. but reinforcing somebody's suffering doesn't help at all. Understanding, and the only way we can understand that is to take to the Dhamma. That's why you've all heard me say in class, the most loving thing I can do for myself, for the people I care most about, and for all sentient beings is to take to the Dhamma wholeheartedly. It's the only way that I can really love you. It's the only way that I can really be compassionate and be helpful to you or to anyone else or to the planet. You know, we're all concerned about all the problems on the planet. The problems on the planet today are exactly the same as when the Buddha was, except maybe the environmental issues. They weren't so widespread. But they were pretty bad. I mean, you couldn't drink a lot of the water back then either. But the Buddha didn't work against things. He didn't work against governments. He didn't work against kings. In fact, what he did was he invited, I was talking to Debbie before, two of the most brutal kings of the Buddha's time and just slightly after, Bimbisara and later after the Buddha's death was Ashokan, were brutal people. Ashokan was known, it's pretty gross to talk about, but he was like the Cambodian killing fields of India. He loved to show these great displays of violence, and he'd leave them out there for other people to see so they would fear him. He came across the Dhamma about 300 years after the Buddha passed, and it completely turned him around to the point where even today he's probably the biggest supporter of the teachings of the Buddha that the world has ever seen. Mm-hmm. It's because of Ashokan that Buddha traveled south into Sri Lanka and then all to that part of Southeast Asia. There's still statues and stupas and temples that Ashokan built because he was so taken. He never took another human life after he encountered the Dhamma. That's the practical change in view that takes place. He went from being someone who thought that he needed to be a murderous monster in order to keep himself going to someone who, in a very real way, affected millions of people even today by him taking to the Dhamma and then expressing it as best he could. So that's what the Buddha didn't take causes. What he did was he tried to change people's thinking. The culture of India at that time, and it probably would still happen, anybody that was ruling, any of the kings, there was also a beginning of a form of a democratic kind of government in areas of India too. But whoever the leader was, they wanted to have the most renowned spiritual teacher under their wing, that they wanted to sponsor them. So everybody wanted to sponsor the Buddha. But he did. He played the game wisely. When a king said, come and live with me for a while, the Buddha said, I will, but I'm going to teach you the Dhamma. You know, he knew it was useless for him to get into that situation unless he could further the understanding of people. You know? We've gotten a little bit off track from dependent origination, but the point is that we awaken through understanding, and that's when we can have a real effect on other people too. But first we have to understand what's going on with us. I don't want to go too late today either, so I'm going to be a little mindful of time. So then the Buddha describes in slightly more detail and in reverse order each of the 12 links. So what is aging and death? Aging is decrepitude, brokenness, graying, declining, weakening of the faculties. Death is the passing away of the aggregates, the five clinging aggregates. The ending of time, that's an interesting line, and I've done my best to see if that's really what the Buddha said, and the different ways that I've looked at it, that's really what he meant. The ending of time. Remember what the Dalai Lama said about time. The purpose of time is to awaken. So we've either ended time without awakening, or we have. And the next line is just as interesting. The interruption of the faculties. He doesn't say that death is the ending of the faculties. It's the interruption of the faculties. The faculties that he's talking about that are part of this 12 causative links. It's the interruption. Just because we die doesn't mean that we've ended those 12 causative links born of ignorance. Death does not end the suffering born of ignorance. Physical death. So now what is birth? Birth is the descent. The coming forth, the coming to be. Birth is the appearance of the six sense bases in the five clinging aggregates. Now what is becoming? Becoming is sensual becoming, form becoming, and formless becoming. Why is he talking about form becoming and formless becoming? Formless becoming is karma unfolding after death. And I'll get into more of that tomorrow night. The difference between becoming and birth is subtle, but it's the causative action of ignorance that initiates becoming, resulting. Becoming is that process in between ignorance and birth, even in the moment-by-moment birth. So this is explaining that the belief in a self is reinforced by sensual contact and is proliferated by believing in an individual personality being born, i.e. becoming form, and the same individual personality becoming formless at death, but surviving as the same personality, either in an eternal formless state or being reborn as the same soul. The Buddha is saying that there's a continuum, but it's not as an individual. If I'm unlucky enough to awaken, I'm not going to be born again in the next life. But there's a continuum of energy that's driving that. And again, I'll talk more about that tomorrow night. Becoming birth, sickness, old age, death, and non-becoming is the environment of dukkha caused initially by ignorance. The links of clinging, craving, just a page. The links of clinging, craving, feeling, contact, and sinks. Wait a minute. The links of clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense bases, name and form, consciousness and fabrications are all part of the process of a self arising from ignorance. This process is maintained by continued ignorance furthering karma. I don't want to know. Or we complicate even the Dhamma so much that it has no effect. Because then we don't have to deal with the reality of our own confusion. The Buddha then describes how clinging to the notion of self maintains this feedback loop of senses establishing a self and maintaining the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. And what is clinging and maintaining? There are four types of clinging. Clinging to sensual stimulus, clinging to views, and that's conditioned thinking, clinging to precepts and practices, and clinging to a doctrine of self. Precepts and practices, think about India at that time. There was a lot of ritualistic practices as part of developing understanding. There's a lot of animal sacrifice. And so he's talking about that type of thing, but it's also applicable today to all the rituals we create in our own lives, whether they're spiritual or just ritualistic in the things that we do to maintain a self. Ritualistic thinking. And that's part of that doctrine of self. We create a belief in what this is, and a doctrine is created about it, and we continually reinforce that doctrine, almost like a religion. You know, a good example of that in the West is, I'm opening something up, I don't want to, excuse me for that. The Buddha here has taken a methodical route from the ultimate unfolding of ignorant suffering and suffering arising from birth back to the second noble truth, or the origination of dukkha, clinging. Along the way, he describes what is cling to, a self that is dependent and continued on continued craving and continued sensory stimulus to be maintained. It is important to remember now that the teachings on dependent co-arising are given to develop understanding of the Four Noble Truths. This sutta explains the process of how all personal phenomena arises so that understanding of the distraction of dukkha can be realized. It teaches right view while pointing out that holding wrong or ignorant view is the cause of confusion and suffering. You know, our suffering originates in ignorance, and our salvation originates in wisdom. At the same intersection, you know, at the same point, at the same development of we're talking about knowing and not knowing. A little bit further on in this chapter, the Buddha describes more how craving arises from feeling. So now the Buddha describes how craving arises from feeling and how feeling is caused by contact. And what is craving? There are six classes of craving. Craving for forms, for a physical experience. Craving for sounds. Now the Buddha is describing how our sixth sense basis gets involved in craving. Craving for sounds, craving for smells, craving for tastes, craving for physical sensations, and craving for ideas. And what is feeling? Feeling has six classes as well. Feeling arising from eye contact, from ear contact, from nose contact, from taste contact, from body contact, and from intellect contact. This is called feeling. Something happens, we decide what our experience of it is going to be, and it results in a feeling. And what is contact? Phenomenon contacting the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the intellect. This is contact with the six sense bases. And what is name and form? Feeling, perception, intention, attention, these are all mental aspects, and contact. Discriminating consciousness is name. The elements of water, fire, earth, and wind, that which makes up the physical forms, is called forms. Name and form is discriminating consciousness bound to or clinging to the physical form. And what is consciousness? There are six classes of consciousness: eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and intellect consciousness. So it's not the kind of magical, mystical consciousness that we usually refer to. As far as the Buddha is concerned, it's a specific consciousness that's tied to each sense. And what are fabrications? There are three fabrications: bodily fabrications, verbal fabrications, and mental fabrications. You know, this is getting subtly back to right speech and looking at our verbal fabrications. That's what comes out. We can understand what our physical and mental fabrications by looking at our verbal fabrications. It's a very clear way of seeing what we've created in our own minds as what's important. The Buddha now describes ignorance. Ignorance is not knowing stress, not knowing the origination of stress, not knowing the cessation of stress, and not knowing the eightfold path leading to the cessation of stress. That's ignorance. Now, the Buddha's words were, in the English translation, is this is ignorance. That's the kind of ignorance. That's the only thing that we need to know. We don't have to extrapolate ignorance to something else, to some idea that we have of ignorance. As far as the Eightfold Path, ignorance is just not understanding the Four Noble Truths, which brings us directly to right view. So that this whole teaching on dependent origination and how we got to where we are, the only thing we really need to remember is that it's born of ignorance. And if we want to do something about it, develop a practice that's founded in wisdom. Debbie.
Can you give me an example of a physical fabrication? I understand verbal fabrication.
The physical fabrication is believing that this physical body that we interpret through this ego personality is who we are. And then we take that one step further and join this physical body to all physical phenomenon and overemphasize the importance of that. In other words, this is all we know, and we continue to defend this physical form. Now remember the teachings on impermanence, even though it's impermanent and insubstantial.
So how would you defend the physical form?
Where did that come from? I'm sorry, what did you say more? This disembodied being. Yeah. I didn't hear you more.
I think I said, so how give an example of how we would defend a this deluded sense of I am this.
Oh, any,
what would it look like?
Any view that I hold of myself,
so
that
what would it look like?
I'm gonna give me a minute. Any view that I hold of myself that is threatened and that I continue to maintain, and that could be anything. So, I'll give you an example. I'm trying to think of one that's impersonal instead of personal, so I don't shine a light on myself. Because that leads to other attachments. I'll use just the opposite. Someone who's born extremely tall, someone who Abraham Lincoln's a good example. Yeah, what's that, Marfan syndrome. They're born in a certain, this is just an easier way to forget about Abraham Lincoln. We're born a certain way, and it's a way that we don't approve of. Could be short, tall, long, could be the wrong colored skin, could be the wrong anything, the wrong family, the wrong side of the street. We're in a situation that we ourselves don't approve of, and we don't want anybody else to know about it. And so we create all kinds of scenarios around that single thing. And it's the maintenance of that, all those different scenarios, trying to defend who we think, who we are, that creates such stress and unhappiness. Was that not a good example?
So but
if it wasn't, tell me.
Say if you're saying you're tall and you wish you weren't tall, it's like weird and you feel awkward and everything. So you develop this whole sense of self. But what would that sense of self look like that you're defending?
You create a construct in your mind that even though you think you're screwed up or there's something wrong with you, but you're okay. And you continually create that, or you continually are stuck in that self-reflective view.
So even though I'm tall and I look like a freak, I'm really smart. I'm really funny.
It could be anything. Really, it could be worse than that.
But that's like the more concrete. I think the more people can relate.
Mm-hmm.
I can relate to it rather than an abstract concept. So
another.
I'm really tall, but I'm going to keep on defending. So okay, so look at me. I think I'm ugly, right?
Another good example would be a child who is told continually that they're bad or they're wrong. You know, we do that a lot in our society. It's a practical example. We think that the best way to teach somebody is to first tell them how screwed up they are. You know, and you take on that. You take that idea that there's something wrong with me. Another good example, as I'm talking about it, is the idea of original sin, that we're born with something wrong with us. And many people believe that, and they take it to a great extreme. No matter what I do, I'll never be good enough. You know, that's its own kind of mental disease. So
that would be a mental fabrication or a bodily fabrication.
Well, it's experienced in this body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, the Dhamma is not a linear or a separate thing. All these things are part of one package.
John, may I ask you a question?
Sure.
I wonder if we can go back to Laura's example of someone who, for whatever reason, rejects their physical appearance and then is compensating for that self-loathing by identifying positive characteristics. I got lost there. Is that still incorrect? Because it's through identifying those positive characteristics, I have a good sense of humor, I'm very intelligent. Is that still incorrect because it's reinforcing a sense of a concrete self?
That's it. That's the reason. So even though the notions that we're creating to compensate for the initial negative view are so-called positive, it's still reinforcing a view of yourself. And that's the problem. Anything that we do that reinforces this notion of self is a mental fabrication, and it's manifested in a physical form.
Okay. So may I ask then, how the Buddhist teachings guide us to understand who we are in this moment, contained within acceptance that it's shifting and changing, but within this moment, if I cook a dish that's delicious, I want to, and I do in my life, have a sense of delight and happiness and pleasure that I made something nutritious that's good for people and they can enjoy, and pride, I did it. So may I ask for, using an example such as that, that I did something altruistically good and I'm happy with myself that I did it, and I'm aware that that's a very concrete sense of self, how would the Buddha guide me to view that? Is a more skillful view delicious, nutritious food and happiness and just taking myself out of it?
The difficulty would arise when it reinforces your view of yourself, and you get arrogant. I've made this delicious dinner. I am so incredibly wonderful. And that's reinforcing. Instead of preparing a delicious meal because the understanding that it nourishes another human being. You know, and this is bringing it back into the framework of the Eightfold Path. What is my intention to make the meal? Is there any aspect of clinging in that? Or is it simply to make a meal, to be mindful of making a delicious, nutritious meal for someone?
This could also go back to when I would agree with the way deeds are done.
To what?
This could also go back to events happen, deeds are done, but there is no doer, though.
Well, yeah, but again, to bring it back into the framework of the Eightfold Path, the intention that we do something is everything, and as far as the Dhamma is concerned. You know? So we can get ourselves...
suffering.
What? Well, does it contribute to unbinding or does it not? Is it reestablishing the self or is it not?
So what I hear this is, if my intention is to cook a great meal but let everybody know I cooked a great meal, I've already started with the wrong intention.
Probably.
So there's more to go from there.
But let me say this.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I've already started with the wrong intention.
Yeah.
It's shifting my intention.
That's the key. That's what I've been talking about the soul and wanted to get it. That's why I keep reinforcing this. If you weigh that idea within the framework of the Eightfold Path, you'll realize, well, my intention, what is my intention here? What is my intention for anything? What's our intention, right? We started the retreat with our intention. Our intention was to actually be on retreat, you know, to develop an understanding. Intention is everything. I have a real good friend of mine who's been a practicing Buddhist for 30 years. And the argument we always have is, he says intention has nothing to do with what the Buddha taught. I don't know how you can say that, but he insists. It fits into his view. Everything starts with right intention. You know, what is our intention? What is our intention for getting out of bed in the morning? You know, we should look at that. You know, what is my intention for making this meal for my friends? And you could drive yourself crazy too. This is where you could get too analytical. Well, is my intention to just feed my friends a nourishing meal? What do I mean, mine? You know, stop. You got to stop someplace and be reasonable with yourself. don't be clinging to, this is what the Buddha's talking about, don't be clinging to precepts and rituals. Don't be ritualistic in your thinking. Don't try to take things so far that you're just confusing yourself more. You know, don't play riddle games. There's some aspects of Buddhism that are really big on riddles. In my experience, it's not helpful to try to fool ourselves. See what's in front of us. You know, most experiences, when weighed in the light of the Eightfold Path, it's apparent where we are with it. You know, and again, the Buddha's sole reason for teaching something as slightly complicated as dependent co-arising is just to show us that it's out of ignorance all of this arises from. You can kind of forget about the other, you know, the 10 intervening steps and just understand that I'm suffering, I'm confused because of ignorance. If you wanted to learn to play baseball, but you insisted on watching a golf video, you're going to remain ignorant of baseball. If you want to learn baseball, find a good baseball teacher, find a good coach. If you want to learn the Dhamma, if you want to learn how to develop lasting peace and happiness, you can't watch a golf video, you know? You practice the Dhamma. You go back to the problem of ignorance. The Buddha starts his teaching with the Four Noble Truths. There is stress. Why is there stress? Because we don't understand. There's ignorance. Taking it to the Fourth Noble Truth, the Eightfold Path shines the light of wisdom on ignorance. And then, from ignorance, birth doesn't occur because there's no ignorance. I'm not going to get into the clinging aggregates tonight. I think that's more than enough, right? I'll touch on it tomorrow, and we're developing a thorough understanding of the teachings of the Buddha, you know, and that's the purpose. We're not going to cover every concept in a 4-day weekend, nor would it be useful. You know, I think you'd agree. It's almost getting overwhelming, right? And I don't mean to. I'm trying to pace this in a way that what I talk about is useful, but not so overwhelming. So the key concepts, what we've been talking about since last night, really not that long, is that the Four Noble Truths are the teachings of the Buddha. The Eightfold Path is the path that we develop in order to develop lasting peace and happiness. The point of all of this is to empty ourselves of clinging, and that there's a simple and direct cause for what we're experiencing right now, and that's dependent co-arising. The only reason I put that up on the board that way is so that we understand there's a difference between what's usually taken as dependent origination and what the Buddha intended. It's okay to believe that we're all interconnected or there's an interdependence playing out here. There is on a very subtle level, but that's not this teaching. Remember that out of ignorance, suffering arises.
I think that, you know, a lot of the dialogue has been conceptual in the absence of examples on dependent origination. Was repeated many times without example. I think these things are very simple and very basic, but because the concepts are repeated over and over and over again without the example, it becomes banal, repeated words with no meaning.
As you're talking, I'm trying to think of the example. The practical example is sitting right here. You know.
I mean, simply, let's pick one: dependent origination.
What do you mean? Pick one aspect, one of the causative links.
No. What do you mean by dependent?
The 12 causative links that lead from ignorance to suffering.
Go on.
I'm not sure I'm following what you're looking for.
For example.
Dependent origination.
Well, let me. I happen to be on this page again. I read it before. What is ignorance? Ignorance is not knowing stress. That's not a concept. That's a direct teaching that if you're ignorant of the cause of stress, you'll continue to create the cause of stress in your life. So we don't need to know I use the example of, we don't need to know what's ignorance of baseball in order to develop an understanding of the Dhamma. We do need to know that it's ignorance of stress. It's ignorance of the problem that we have. We don't know it. We don't know why we have stress in our lives. Why are we unhappy? Why are we confused? You know, these are, again, these are the great questions that people had. Why, I mean, you take it to an extreme. Why am I here? What's my purpose? The Buddha left the palace grounds because he saw suffering and he wanted to understand it. He wanted to understand it so that he could possibly find a way to end it, and that's just what he did. So the beginning of dependent origination is ignorance, being ignorant of stress. And then the Buddha goes on, being ignorant of the cause of stress, which is clinging. Ignorance is being ignorant, not understanding that cessation of stress is possible. And ignorance is further proliferated by not understanding the Eightfold Path as the path leading to the ending of stress or ignorance. So, it's the teachings. And a real example of that, a concrete example, is the Buddha's life. There's no better example of a human being awakening than taking into account the Buddha. You know, that's one of the reasons why we take refuge in the three jewels, in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. We take refuge in the Buddha because we recognize that a human being awakened to the true nature of reality. He put aside all ignorance and ended stress and unhappiness for himself. That's what he taught. Does that help?
Well, that to me, that goes without being said. It's somehow we're missing the essence.
Let me see what Lisa has, and maybe it'll help.
No, what I was thinking is, so, for example, can you walk me through the 12 pieces with the Buddha's life? I think that would be so great to see where each of those pieces kind of popped up in his story.
You have to do it in reverse order. The Buddha was born a prince in his father's kingdom. He had every luxury that any human being could have. Upon the Buddha's birth, his parents were told that he's either going to be a great spiritual leader or a great political leader. And his dad wanted him to continue the family business and be a great political leader. So he protected the Buddha from everything outside of the palace grounds. He protected him from knowing any stress and unhappiness, thinking that if he could keep him here and ignorant, he would not seek to change the world through spiritual means. I don't usually use the word spiritual, but that in this context, it's. So the Buddha, ignorance was almost imposed on the Buddha by his environment. Right? It was designed to remain ignorant. Throughout his youth, and there's not a lot of stories about the Buddha's youth, but you can kind of glean that he wasn't the happiest of children, even though he indulged in all the senses. Even when he was young puberty, his father gave him a lot of beautiful women. You know, again, he always had the best clothes, the finest perfumes, the greatest food, the greatest entertainment constantly, even from being a little boy. And there was always an uneasiness about the Buddha. There was an uneasiness that grew out of that ignorance. You know, he knew that the way he was being shown the world was not, there was something missing. It was incorrect. At the age, I'll fast forward because it's getting late. At the age of 29, he left the palace grounds, and I'll cut some of this out. For the first time, and he was with his handler Chanda. He's walking down the street in the local town, and he saw a man on the side of the street retching. Every story has it different, but I'll say the guy's retching. The Buddha never saw that before, and he asked Chanda, "What's wrong? What's going on here?" He said, "Well, that man is sick." He says, "Everybody gets sick at some point." And this is starting to turn the Buddha's head around. He can't understand this at all. This makes no sense. Why would a human being get sick? How can that happen? He walks a little further, and there's an old man with a cane walking slowly. He says, "Chanda, what's that?" He says, "Well, that's an old man." He says, "Everybody gets old and starts to fade away." He says, "That's just part of living." And this is really, the Buddha's reeling now. He walks around a corner, and there's a corpse laying on the road. "Chanda, what happened? Why is that man sleeping there?" He said, "He's not sleeping, he's dead." "Dead? What is that?" "Everybody dies." He said, It's just part of life. We all die. The Buddha can't reconcile this. He walks a little further and he sees and feels the tension in the people. He sees suffering in their faces. He starts to understand what it's like to live out in the world without the protection of your king and living in that beautiful place. He starts getting an understanding of loss that leads to suffering, the tension just being involved in making a living and striving to survive in this world.
Is that the fabrication?
That's a good question. He's getting caught up in the fabrication of the world around him, and he's seeing it in a certain way. He's seeing suffering as something that's concrete and unavoidable. But it also doesn't make sense with his own inner knowing. There's something inside the Buddha that's saying, there's got to be a way of understanding this. And so he spent 6 years trying to understand these fabrications that he came. If he didn't have the fabrications, it's a good point. If he didn't have the fabrications born of his sense inputs as he left the palace grounds, impacted by his consciousness, forming these fabrications, he would have known instantly what the answer was. But he didn't. He was ignorant of the answer. And so he went and did what we're doing now. He seeked out the Dhamma, developed an understanding of the true nature of reality, and then awoken. That's what the Buddha means. He awakened. He was no longer ignorant. And that's what he taught. So does that example of the Buddha's life, of someone, a human being, who went from that ignorance of not knowing, not understanding stress, now understands it.
So what I'm hearing is, so he comes out, and he has dukkha, because he's out there, what the heck's going on? It takes him 6 years just to figure that component out. And because I'm looking at page 158, because that's where you were talking from. And then, so from the fabrications comes consciousness. So then he became aware. And from the consciousness, he was giving it a name, a form, it's death, it's figuring, and he continued to figure it out. And then the sixth sense is, like, I'm just playing it through.
Yeah.
So he saw it, he felt it, he heard it from the wailing of the people that were around him. And then from the sixth sense, a sixth sense basis as a requisite condition comes contact. From contact, the condition comes feeling, so he was having a reaction to that.
Aversion.
Yeah.
Many of us have
born of the ignorance of not knowing what's going on in front of him.
And then it comes into, and then it continues to craving, and that's, well, I don't want to die, I want to stay alive, you know, we don't want, you know, when all these wonderful things to happen, and then craving is clinging and maintaining. And then from the clinging and maintaining, condition becomes becoming. And then from becoming is comes birth. So it's...
starts over.
Now right. think about a newborn baby. Does a newborn baby have wisdom or is it ignorant of its environment?
Neither.
Well, it's ignorant. It doesn't. A newborn baby does not have any understanding of its environment.
It doesn't even know that it's a baby. It still thinks it's alive.
Just gradually.
So that's a concrete example of a human baby is born ignorant. It knows nothing of its environment, and as it develops usually a view, a conditioned way of looking at the world, depending on its environment and its experience.
But when it is born, does it have already formed itself? Does it already have that separation between? So,
that's one of those questions that nobody really knows that, and the Buddha wouldn't answer that question. Yeah. Again, keep it within this framework of dependent origination, and don't try to bring, and I'm not telling you specifically, don't try to find an exception to what the Buddha's teaching as dependent origination. It's a simple teaching on how from ignorance suffering arises. Mm. That's all that the Buddha's concerned about. Out of ignorance, suffering arises. And that idea, that example I just gave of a baby, think about the first thing that happens to a baby usually. It's given a swat to wake up, to come into the world. It's born of suffering. If you take the understanding that the Buddha the whole Buddha Dhamma takes you to is to end rebirth, end the whole, I'll talk about this tomorrow night, but I'll talk about it tonight. The whole point is to not keep putting ourselves in this situation where we're suffering. Born of ignorance, we suffer. We bring suffering. Gain wisdom through the Dhamma, through seeing things clearly. Forget about the metaphysical and the magical aspects. Forget about the esoteric. Forget about the things that we don't know. What we do know is out of ignorance, suffering arises. What we do know is that what we think of ourselves is not who we are. It's not that. That's Buddha saying it. It's not you. It's not what you think you are. If we had a little more time and I got into the five clinging aggregates, that might help make it a little bit clearer, but I'm not too sure. The five clinging aggregates simply explain the elements of a physical body that cling to phenomenon to create a self. Another way of saying that is what we associate with is what defines ourselves. Right? Does that make sense or no? We define ourselves by our associations and by what we join ourselves to. The first thing we join ourselves to is an identity of John or Matt or Dave or Jim. That begins to give us something to defend continually. And where does that Matt or John, etc., arise from?
A lifetime of input, reactions.
Yeah. And the reaction originates in ignorance. Or but that's the point. And so suffering is continued by ignorance. The simplicity of the teaching might be what's making it so complicated. So why do we have, the question is, why do we have the Dhamma? To bring wisdom into ignorance. To obviate ignorance, so that it's not there anymore. So that from ignorance, suffering doesn't occur. Remember why I started this, to make clear why the Buddha taught dependent origination. Just to shine the light on the problem is ignorance. And out of ignorance, all these other things occur. But don't look at it as a linear progression. The example, although it may not be acceptable, is the life of the Buddha. It's the best example. But our own lives are the example, too. Your life is an example of dependent origination.
For some reason, it doesn't seem to clarify anything by calling it dependent origination.
Well, we could call it anything, I guess. But I think dependent co-arising is a better word, but I know that doesn't help you. But it's simply the words that are used to describe the process from ignorance.
Perhaps you phrase it. Perhaps you approach it from another way. I'm somehow repeating that.
Well, but it's as a...
Imagine that I have a seed here. Mm-hmm. That seed won't go anywhere unless I water it. It's dependent on the water in order to grow.
Oh, sure.
Thing to manifest, it's dependent upon other elements to come together at that moment.
And so the Buddha's teaching, for suffering to arise, ignorance must be present. So you asked me to use a different word to describe it. The reason why I won't is because I'm hoping to teach the Dhamma. And so if I call it something else, it doesn't relate to the teachings. You know, my whole point of teaching dependent origination tonight is to be clear of what it is and why the Buddha taught it. So the Buddha did not teach the 12 causative links, and it's referred to as something. I mean, in Pali, it's something else. I have the words right here. But calling it something else, it's still dependent origination within the teachings. If you don't completely understand it, it's not a failure of your intellect, and it's not like you're just not ready, and I don't think it's a failure. I don't take it as a failure. But it is a difficult concept because it goes against everything. It's something that we should be with and be aware of. You don't have to have complete knowledge of it for it to be useful. Just understand that from ignorance, suffering arises. And so if you notice that you're suffering, you need to look for some, to develop some wisdom. And where do we develop that is within the Eightfold Path. I don't think that's very satisfying to you.
The Eightfold Path is self-evident, you know. It seems like dependent origination is just the sum total of all the sensory input and our reaction to it from day zero.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is.
If we said something like that earlier, instead of, and I don't mean to attack you on this, but to label it as if it's as simple as that, then.
Well, again, that's another reason that I'm hoping to bring clarity rather than confusion. Because most people, even within the Buddhist world, don't understand dependent origination and how simple and basic it is. Maybe not so simple and basic. They think that it's something else, and they want it to be something else. But it's just that. This is the Sutta on dependent origination. You know, the Buddha describing how from ignorance suffering arises. And you can kind of...
The words you use, dependent origination, just happen to be the current English translation of the Pali words.
Yeah, and actually I prefer dependent co-arising, but I know that doesn't... Mm-hmm. But that's what, in the Buddhist teaching, that's what we're referring to, you know?
Right, in the English teaching.
Yeah, in the English teaching.
Right, so, you know,
I could call it ignorance proliferated, you know? But it wouldn't relate to anything in the Dhamma that way.
Rather than focusing on the sum total of this mess that sits before you, the focus on remedy would help this one here. Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why I brought it up. The remedy for ignorance is wisdom, and that's the Eightfold Path.
Well, okay.
That's again, what did the Buddha teach? He taught understanding stress and understanding the path leading to the cessation of stress or dukkha or unhappiness. You know, that's what he taught. So the only thing that dependent origination does is it supports those teachings by explaining how this arises in the first place. That question comes up often. Well, how did I get into this mess? Where did it come from? It came from ignorance.
But the steps of dependent origination are actually turned backwards in the process of gaining wisdom. You just basically jump back to the beginning, ignorance.
Well, yes and no. I think that you start gaining an understanding of how our senses actually create the problem. Mm. You know, we're usually enamored by our senses. By eye consciousness, that beautiful sunset, you know, that can be something that we experience mindfully in the moment and understand that it's in this present moment, or it can be something that we hold on to through impact, through eye consciousness. But that can be any sensory experience. That's what that's taking us through. That's that process. Something first has to impact our physical senses. We decide yay or nay on it. Either one is going to get us in trouble, and suffering arises. Instead of having the wisdom to know, to be simply mindful of this present moment, to have that developed concentration, to simply see what's there without discriminating consciousness. Discriminating consciousness arises out of ignorance. It doesn't see things clearly. We don't have to make things a big riddle. We can just see what's there.
Part, getting you in trouble. New car?
Yeah, it's a great example, you know. Or, you know, buying a Lexus when a Beetle is what you really can afford. You know, that's a very practical example of our eye consciousness or any other kind of consciousness creating problems. You know, it's all practical, and you can pick a sense. And it can get you in trouble. We all know that. Pick the sense of taste. We can eat too much. You know, pick the sense of feel. You know, we can buy too many nice feeling clothes. We can buy silk instead of cotton. It could be any of those examples. It all starts with that sensory input, you know, the sixth sense base. But if we had the wisdom of understanding what's going on in this present moment, the senses would not lead us into stress and suffering. We'd still have it. The Buddha did not give up his senses when he awakened. They just didn't create, because he had the wisdom of the Buddha, of an awakened one, he didn't continue to create stress and unhappiness in his life.
So we break the chains of the 12 dependent.
And when I think that's exactly what the Buddha is saying, when you reverse that, when you understand suffering, that you're understand that you are suffering, and take the process of developing wisdom, you undo that. You unchain yourself, you break the chain. You unbind yourself. You're the plow cutting the roots of suffering. That's all that the teachings are about. So again, we can't make more of it than there is. Remember that the Buddha taught Four Noble Truths and then how to understand that. That's all he was concerned about. So even this somewhat complicated teaching on the 12 causative links are there to only support that understanding. There's nothing universal about dependent origination. It's about how an individual experiences suffering and why.
So, John, for me, if I created my space, I'm having suffering. And it was funny, I was going to ask you this before, but I answered it so quickly. So I said, well, how do I know that the next thing that I'm going to do is not going to create suffering? But if I go to the Eightfold Path, that's how I know I'm not going to create additional suffering, because I'm going to come at it with a right intent. If I use the Eightfold Path,
yeah,
which is, you know, hopefully what I do, but not always. And then that's how I can stop from where I am.
That's a practice of the Dhamma. That's why we do it. Joy, you had a question?
I wanted to share something from the book. This has been a great discussion.
Yeah.
I have struggled with understanding this. I'll read this when Jim comes back. It's on page 165. And
what part is it, Joy? We can read it twice.
It's starting in the third paragraph. The sentences that I would pick out are that dependent co-arising, the whole, like these six mm-hmm. pages that precede this is the summary to me.
Yeah.
Dependent co-arising shows that from a wrong or ignorant view, the seeming chaos of an impermanent environment is fabricated. It is within this impermanent environment that a sense-based consciousness arises. And this is where stress arises, because this sense-based consciousness is struggling to maintain a permanent and substantial view of itself. And this is where, when I am in that place, I am being ignorant of impermanence and passing. I'll go back to my personal example of anxiety. I am anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's partly correct. And anxiety has arisen in this moment.
Mm.
But making a declaration that I'm anxious is permanent and fixed.
Mm.
Identifying that anxiety has arisen in this moment is spacious.
Mm.
There would be one more sentence that I would read. In the next paragraph, so that's the purpose of these six pages.
Mm-hmm.
Birth to death, death to birth, he used a lot of words. It's language that isn't necessarily fluent to my current, you know, way of reading or thinking or understanding. I have really struggled with this. But so that's dependent co-arising shows, dependent co-arising feeds this false idea of a permanent environment, within this false idea of a permanent environment, the false idea, the wrong view of a permanent person gets fabricated. And then it's the stress of maintaining wrong views, dukkha, that distracts me from recognizing the wrong view. Jim, I found something in here that was very helpful to me. Thank you for your questions and your commentary. I've been relating to it very directly. I've had a lot of frustration with myself about struggling to understand it. So what I found in the book, if you want to look, it's on page 165. So what I plucked out of it, may I restate this?
Please.
Is that okay? That these six pages that describe in great detail, using a lot of language that I am struggling to ease into. It's just very difficult for me to integrate that. But all of this explanation fortifies the understanding that dependent co-arising shows that from a wrong or ignorant view, the seeming chaos of an impermanent environment is fabricated. So that's what all of this history does, is it brings us up to this, brings me up to... So, I want to see if we're there. So, it's... Right. So, dependent co-arising fuels my wrong view of a permanent, fixed existence. Further, it's within this environment that sense-based consciousness arises. And this is where stress comes in, because stress arises as my consciousness is continually struggling to maintain my permanent and substantial view of myself, which in reality is swimming against the tide, because I am not permanent, this is not fixed or permanent, it is ever shifting. Here's the example that I used earlier today. I shared that I struggle with anxiety. And what has come to me over these last 2 days is that a statement that I would have made Wednesday, I'm anxious, is today, Friday, acknowledged as partly true. Today, what I hope, to Lisa's point, that I would say is anxiety has arisen. Anxiety is here. But I'm not a water bottle. I'm not Dave Zebulon. I'm not anxious. That's a fixed idea. Anxiety has arisen. I feel miserable. Right now. That's true. So these concepts of dependent co-arising all coalesce in this wrong or ignorant view of permanence, and it's the stress of maintaining that permanence, known as dukkha, suffering, that prevents me from recognizing how wrong my view is, and that I'm not Dave's water bottle, I'm not anxious, anxiety has arisen, and it will pass. I'm not successful, I have success in this moment, and more will come or it will go. It's creating, I'm understanding this as an invitation to create space that will assist me in this eightfold path work of letting go of fixed views and judging my actions based on other values.
That was excellent.
Thank you.
You make it.
That's because it's not even anxiety, the sensation of arising in the body.
Then and my language for that is X.
If there wasn't a lack of understanding, the anxiety would not arise. It's a practical example of how, from not understanding the true nature of reality, that would create suffering. Understanding the true nature of reality, there's no cause for anxiety. There's nothing there. Joy left out one half of a sentence. A permanent and substantial view of self, while with each moment, in every instant, all things pass away and all things are reborn. We have to, and the point of that is, this brilliant writing, is that we have to, through continual and extreme effort, we maintain that ignorance over and over and over again, because if we didn't, it would simply pass away due to the law of impermanence. Going back to what we talked about this afternoon, all of this occurs, our confusion about DO occurs within the environment of impermanence also. And I'm not putting you or any. It took me a long time to understand how simple this is. I'm suspecting that I'm not teaching it so simply, but
perhaps it's been accidentally overcomplicated.
Well, but again, that's kind of what I started with. We overcomplicate most of these simple teachings of the Buddha so that they become, or we change them to fit our own views, so that they're not useful at all within the framework of the Eightfold Path. That's why it's so important to be able to relate it back to that. Dependent origination, if we want to learn about 24 hours of Le Mans, doesn't do us any good. Dependent origination in brain surgery is not helpful. Dependent origination in developing an understanding of the Dhamma is key, but we can take our time in understanding it. That practical example that Joy gave is it. That's the explanation of dependent origination from ignorance. I became anxious. And from not understanding that, I became more anxious. It's just that practical. If we understand who we are, if we put aside all the views of self, there's nothing for anxiety to originate in. Anxiety is dependent on its origination from ignorance. And it's just through that process. Joy felt that anxiety through her six sense bases. You felt it in the pit of your stomach, that's a body feeling. You had a mental fabrication that brought it on. I mean, it's just a perfect example of it.
Well, of course it's going to be. That almost implies that we're a victim of our senses. Our senses, that's how we...
We are.
How we perceive the world. Well, that's almost implying that they don't serve us well. If we're on a railroad track, we have our eyes closed and our ears plugged.
I don't mean to interrupt you. That's an extreme example of trying to find where the Dhamma doesn't work.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If you're on the train tracks and the train is coming, get off the train tracks. Don't try to prove the Dhamma wrong by getting hit by the train.
No.
But what I'm saying is, within the framework of the Eightfold Path, our senses are what causes the problem. Because of our senses, we attach ourselves to things. Because of our senses, because of the sensory input that causes consciousness to say, I like it or I don't like it, we form views of self. We form ideas of what we need to have. Of course, if we're on the train tracks, we get out of the way. That's not what the Buddha is talking about there. No, but it's a good... I'm glad you brought it up, because you can take this to an extreme. You can say, well, of course we need our senses. When the Buddha awakened, he didn't pluck out his eyes and cut off his ears and stuff his nose. He continued to use his senses, but in a way that's informed by wisdom, not ignorance. He saw things clearly through his senses. So the Buddha is saying that through ignorance, impacting on our senses creates confusion. Arising from wisdom, our senses are an incredible asset as a human being. That's a good example of it. You know, that's an aspect of wisdom. Get out of the way of the train, you know. Or to sleep when we know we need to sleep, when we feel tired. You know, another good example, I can't remember where it came from, but it's, if when you're tired, sleep. You know? That's a practical example of your senses informing you of what to do. When you're hungry, eat. When you're mad, scream, but get over it. Don't continue it. You know? When you're confused, take to a practice that brings understanding. When you're suffering, take to a practice that gets to the root of suffering, which is ignorance, and puts it aside. Charlie.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. For me, there are times when the word ignorance lands a little hard and mm-hmm. it doesn't feel exactly right. And the way that I like to think of it is that we're all evolved beings, evolved from lower forms, where in our process of evolution, these things that arise in us, these emotions, strong emotions, and fear, we get away from the saber-toothed tiger in the day to save ourselves, are natural, they're conditioned, they're ingrained. And so, yeah, the Buddha's wisdom is to awaken to that fact and to use your thought processes to intervene in that moment between the conditioned response and a more thoughtful response.
Yeah, and again, that a response that would either bring us towards awakening or a reaction that furthers this thing called the self, further defines it, further establishes it, you know, and that's the part of right view and right intention that impacts our moment by moment action.
I guess the word ignorance sort of implies a defect.
I agree, it's a harsh word. A lack of understanding is the same thing, a lack of wisdom. You know, but I used it tonight because that's how it's typically how it's written. From ignorance, stress or suffering arises. And maybe that's it. When we have a reaction, we can't learn. You know, we can't accept maybe a simple concept. So if I said from a lack of wisdom, suffering arises, that points a little bit more towards the solution, which is wisdom.
What's the Pali for ignorance?
I can't remember. No. It's I should remember. It's right. But if I told you, it's right there.
Why do you ask?
Because a lot of times those words are actually not wisdom.
Yeah, the Pali word would not necessarily be ignorance. When people that have translated Pali or Sanskrit, these scholars, my cousin's one of them, by the way, and I only say that, that's why I know the difficulty is because one word in Pali or Sanskrit can have hundreds of definitions, not just even a few. So you have to really get into the context of where it's being presented to know the right one or two words to pick. So in the English language, the word that most closely associates to what the Buddha's intention is ignorance. You know, but I know it has a hard charge. I don't like using it. But so in the context of tonight's teaching, it's almost always presented as from ignorance, suffering arises. But it would be just as accurate to say from lacking understanding. You know, from not understanding stress, suffering arises. You know. But we have a charge to these words. Some of us have a charge to dependent origination or dependent co-arising. We go a certain way with it. And that leads to a misunderstanding too. But we're dealing with words. You know, the difficulty of the Dhamma is the words used to describe it. Because the words are just concepts. The only way we can know is to experience it. You know, to take the finger pointing at the moon, it's not the finger, you know. Use the framework of the Eightfold Path to develop our own understanding. The Buddha couldn't teach you to understand dependent co-arising. I can't teach you. The book can't teach you, but it can lead you to your own understanding. It lead you to that, yeah, now I get it. I've experienced it in myself. Because you've been exposed to these ideas. If the Dhamma wasn't still here, if the lineage of the Dhamma wasn't present in this room in this moment, there'd be nothing to awaken to. But since it's here, since it's in our minds, that's the when we refer to the three jewels, it's that it's the preciousness of the Buddha's example, the preciousness of the Dhamma within our own minds, expressed beautifully here in our Sangha. That's the real jewels of existence, you know. And they're still here. They've always been here since the Buddha's first teaching. And also remember, all the 45 years that the Buddha taught was to support and develop understanding of that one thing, of dukkha. You know, he brought up the Pali. Dukkha has so many other words. You know, and one of them isn't really related. Dukkha can mean stress, unhappiness, disappointment, disenchantment. It also can mean confusion born of ignorance. It's dukkha. You know, confusion born of ignorance. We're confused because we're lacking wisdom. Deb, are you coming back down? Or have you had enough?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, we are going to meditate some tonight, but we'll see. Should I wait or no? Okay. That was another long evening, but I guess it was necessary. I'm sure it was necessary. I hope that we've developed a better understanding of dependent origination and how it relates. Is there anything else that we should talk about on this before we meditate? Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.